is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
So now when these guys come to my office, that's my son. He's 18, 19, and he's got his future. And I have a different view of coaching. I go about it with a different lens. I enjoy my time with them. I like to laugh with them. And that 18 to 22 is such a transformative age and time of these young men. The fact that I get to be a part of it. The wins are great. I want to win. I want to win championships. I still have goals and dreams and visions, even at 50 years old. Yeah, we're going to work for 2 hours, and I'm not always going to say nice things to you. I'm not always going to tell you you're wonderful, but it's never personal. You come to my office, we're going to talk about a myriad of things, and I enjoy that relationship.
Andre Cook is entering his 14th season as the head men's basketball coach at St. Edward's University in Austin, Texas. He has led St. Edward's to 9 winning seasons in his tenure, with an overall record of 221 and 152, including a program record 30 wins in 2018-2019. That season, the Hilltoppers snagged the Heartland Conference regular season title, Heartland Conference Tournament Championship, and advanced to the NCAA Regional Final, while being ranked as high as number 2 nationally during the season. Cook was named the 2019 Clarence Gaines Award winner, given by CollegeInsider.com to the Division II National Coach of the Year and NABC District Coach of the Year. Cook came to St. Edward's from Hudson Valley Community College, where he compiled an overall record of 119-40 in his 5 seasons. He previously served as an assistant at Union College from 1994 to 1996 while earning his master's degree in teaching social studies. Cook also coached basketball at Hudson Falls High School from 1996 to 2004, where he taught and served as assistant principal. Cook played 4 years at Skidmore College and is in the top 10 in scoring at Skidmore with over 1,000 points. In 2012, Cook was inducted into the Capital District Basketball Hall of Fame in Albany, New York. Hey Hoopheads, I wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is former NBA player CJ Watson, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
3R Basketball, powered by Under Armour, is coming to Cleveland this fall. Get your 3-on-3 team together and register at ua3rbasketball.com. Prepare like the pros with the all-new FastDraw and FastScout. FastDraw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off FastDraw and FastScout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improve communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. Be prepared to take some notes as you listen to this episode with Andre Cook, men's basketball head coach at St. Edward's University in Austin, Texas. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klintzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight, and we are pleased to welcome to the podcast the head men's basketball coach at St. Edward University in Austin, Texas, Andre Cook. Andre, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Thanks for having me, Mike. Appreciate you and Jason.
Absolutely. We are excited to be able to have you on and looking forward to diving into all the things that you've been able to do in your coaching career. Want to start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell us a little bit about some of your first experiences with the game of basketball, what you remember from those early years.
Mike, I can actually remember the day, 40 years ago. it's really like I can actually pinpoint a day. My local friends, we were all baseball players and kind of sandlot football players. And this is, they went to the Catholic school, I went to the public school, and we're in in fourth grade, and after school one day in the fall, we're throwing the football around in my friend's yard, and the mother came home and said, hey, we got to get ready, we're eat because we got basketball tryouts tonight. I said, basketball tryouts? Where do you guys got tryouts? Oh, we're at St. Basil's. It's $5 and show up for tryouts. I'm like, well, can I go? They said, yeah. I mean, this is literally, I went home, raised by my grandparents, and I said, I need $5 for tryouts. And, I met, went to tryouts and met Mr. DeBacco, who, changed my basketball and athletic life at St. Basil's when I was 9 years old.
It's amazing how much of an impact a coach in a youth level can have. And I think sometimes we forget that those people that get us off to such a really good start in whatever sport it might be, those people have such a huge impact on whether or not a kid sticks with it. And I think sometimes we forget. So when you think back to the adults that had that influence on you early on, what are some things you remember about just the way that they coached or the things that they did or how they built relationships with you that sort of stuck with you and made you want to stick with hoops?
Yeah, I appreciate that question because it allows me to talk about Orlando DeBacco. Mr. DeBacco, the first coach, his son, Orlando DeBacco Jr. currently is the head coach at our high school that we went to. His dad was, he had four kids, sons, daughters that played basketball. And he used to open a gym at St. Basil's. He had great energy. Artists was all about the fundamentals. I can remember him opening a gym in summers for us when we were 10, 11 years old. And we just had tremendous respect for us. He was also involved in the Little League. And, he coached us, him and Mr. Haber, another Jim Haber, coached us all the way through 8th grade, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th grade, we just had so much fun. It's funny, but I this past weekend I was home back in Albany, New York, and that one of those friends I was telling you, Frank, my best friend Frank, we were together this weekend. I went to my niece's wedding and we got to hang out. And, we loved our childhood. We don't remember how much money we had. I grew up the youngest of 11, right? I didn't know that we didn't have any money.
For sure.
But people like Mr. DeBacco and, the organization, those youth organizations and all of that just made it a wonderful childhood. And really, I loved baseball as a kid, but Mr. DeBacco was the first one to really open up that basketball door. Because I really didn't know what I was doing at 9 years. I was just kind of an athlete that, hey, my boys are going to the basketball tryouts. And I was going to go with them.
So once you started getting into basketball a little bit more, what was your process for getting better? Were you one of those kids that had a plan like, hey, I'm going to do this, I'm going to get better, I'm working out on my own? Or was it more just, I just love to play and I'm finding pickup games? Just what did you do, let's say, as a high school player to really improve yourself as a player?
It was, then you transition from Mr. Abaco to my high school coach to still, a very important factor in my life, George Martin. So now I kind of put Mr. Abaco pushing me off to Coach Martin, who I knew. And now I kind of, my shift went from, as a kid loving baseball and to now basketball was my love. And it was, I love being in the gym with him. I can remember, those old school weight vests. Looking back, they probably are the reason why I can't sleep right now. Those old school weight vests, running up hills, getting shots off. Like, it was, George Martin really took allowed me to go to that next level of, man, I think this is something that I want to do. I think I want to try to be a, I remember, but it's funny, my baseball ended at 18. I played in the Connie Mack Regional Championship, and we lost to Manny Ramirez. I walked off to Manny Ramirez.
Oh, man.
Manny Ramirez, you being, Cleveland, right?
Oh, for sure, man. We love Manny. Absolutely.
Manny Ramirez, I played for Youth Services of the Bronx. Manny Ramirez, Francisco Rodriguez, they beat us to go to the Connie Mack World Series. I walked off the baseball diamond, and that was the last time I touched a bat and ball. And it was just, you know, I was always about basketball and wanting to be, play college basketball. And George Martin was just, you know, we were, you know, again, he's going to be 77 years old this month, and I still talk to him regularly, and he really needs it. George Martin was my history teacher and a basketball coach, and my relationship with him cemented the fact in my life that that's exactly what I want to do.
What about him would you say, when you think about yourself as a coach today, what are some things that you've still got inside of you or that you incorporate into your coaching that you feel like are a result of his influence on you early on?
This is a story that I can remember when I was 10th grade that really changed my thought process. You know, Coach Martin always was and I'm sure I know you guys had dozens and dozens of guests, but I know we'll talk about their high school coach and what they did for them. George Martin was a dot your I's, do cross your T's, don't leave any stone unturned. And I can remember this again. You know, you have these poignant moments in your life, these seminal moments that stick out. Like the day I talked about when I was going to my first tryout. This, I was a sophomore. You know, you know, being from Cleveland, here from the Northeast, weather can change some games.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Weather can change some schedules. So we played a team called Capos, and this is, we beat them 115-50. And the schedule kind of dictated that we played them maybe 2 weeks later, you know, something like that. And we were out of practice, and Coach, you know, quickly got out of practice, threw his overcoat on, and was running out the door. And I said, Coach, where are you going so fast? Like, we literally just got out of practice, and you're running out the door. Because I'm going to go scout Capos. You're going to go scout the home. We just beat them by 65. Take the night off. You know, take the night off. And that was him. And it's like, if this guy can go scout Cajos on a night off, 10 days after us beating them by 65, then I can get some extra jump shots off. I can work on my left hand. I can run that extra lap with that 40-pound weight vest. I can do those things. So this guy is giving us everything he has. And he's the winningest basketball coach in the Albany area. We're so appreciative of him. And that's just one small example, but that really stood out to me. Like, he's going to go scout the host tonight when I would bet 95% of coaches and people would have just took that night off and said, I think we're going to be okay. We just beat it by 65.
Yeah, well, that speaks to, right, the amount of time as a coach that you have to put in, which I think, said it a lot on the podcast, but I don't think the average person, player, parent of a player really understands the amount of time that goes into it. Whether you're talking about on the high school level or the college level, there's just so many things that go on behind the scenes that I just don't think people realize. I think that story does a really good job of illustrating where there's a case. As you said, clearly most coaches probably be like, "Eh, you know, we don't have to worry about it." But
I'm having dinner with my wife tonight, right?
That's right. Is that, which might not be a bad choice in and of itself,
right?
But we know as coaches that we tend to put all that, you know, put our heart and soul into it, and the amount of time that it takes to be great at what you do, it takes a lot of time, and I think that's something, that's a theme that's run through the pod and with conversations with lots of other people. When you think back to that time as a player and playing for Coach Martigan, what's your favorite memory of just being a part of his teams? You know, it could be a moment in a game, could be a moment off the court, just maybe a general feeling. Just what's your memory when you think high school basketball? What immediately comes to mind? What memory pops into your head?
You run small civic center, which again, like, you know, if you're from the Albany area, like, getting to the Glens Falls Civic Center is always a big thing, right? And we made those regular trips every year. And, you know, and we try not to take it for granted that we want to make it feel like it was a rite of passage. But we played in the sectional championship in 89 in Saratoga Catholic. They had a their best player was Gideon Scott Sherry, who played for Dean Smith, who's on Coach Smith's 93 national championship team. And he was an individual assistant now, but was a longtime head coach at High Point. Scott's a good player, 6'5", point guard, you know, really good, especially at our, kind of, 3A, 4A type size high school. And he banked a shot with 1 second to beat us. And he was probably going to bank it in top of the key. Well, I was always a year younger than my guys, the sophomores, juniors, seniors. Well, they all graduated. Who are we playing my senior year? Scott Catholic, Saratoga Catholic. And that year, we were very good. I hit the bucket shot to beat them. So if you went back, from an Albany perspective, people will remember those Spa Catholic matchups.
Do you have that video on tape? You have that shot on tape?
I do. I do. And, nice. I have both of them. I have Scott Sherry's bank shot, and I have mine beating them. Those short shorts are coming back.
Isn't that hard to believe? It's crazy to me. That's a trend I never thought I'd see again.
In that those games, that's Ball Civic Center. Had about 6,000. Held about 6,000. It's a packed house. Like you don't lose those memories, now that I'm like, wow, I'm sure you guys do the same, right? With your kids and like, how where did the time go, right? Like,
it's crazy.
That was over 30 years ago, and I guess when you do what you love, it just goes by really fast.
So true, and yeah, time really goes beyond fast, especially once you have kids. I sent my first one to college, and when we dropped her off, you're looking at it going, wait, I was just holding her in the hospital. How can that I don't know. It goes, it goes fast. Let's put it that way.
Where did 18 years go? I know.
All right. So talk a little bit about your recruitment and your decision to play college basketball and going to Skidmore. Just talk a little bit about the whole process, what you remember about that.
Well, I was, like everybody that you guys talk to, they want to go to Division I, right?
For sure.
Like,
yeah, absolutely.
I averaged 25, 26 points a game as a senior. We won a lot of games. I wanted to go to Division I, and I visited Colgate, with the late, great Jack Bruin, visited Holy Cross with George Blaine. And that's where I was going to go. I was going to go to one of those places. Well, they didn't quite have the same plan. they said, we got somebody, Andre, you're on the board, you're on our list, we're happy to have you, but you're second, third, fourth on the list, whatever it was. And they were, I appreciated it. My grandfather, my grandparents raised 10 kids of their own and raised me as their 11th. They were tough now. My grandfather was tough and he you're going to go to an academic. Things have changed. Now, this is 30 years ago. He's an old school type guy. He didn't feel that they didn't do academic enough. So he was like, you're going to need the best academic situation that you can go to, right? Holy Cross and Colgate didn't work out. So he was like, you're going to go to RPI and become an engineer. There's no question of that. That was it. Like, there's literally – so Mike, you can imagine, okay, didn't work out at Holy Cross Colgate, so now maybe it's like the spring and, getting home visits. So Doc Sowers, who was a great legendary coach at Albany, would be at the house, and my grandfather would say, Doc, great to meet you. Come on in. Let's have a couple of drinks. Let's have a sandwich. He's not going to your school. This is true. This is a true story.
I believe it.
Yeah, Union College coach, come in. Bill Scanlon, great to meet you. Let's have a couple. Have a couple drinks. And I'd be behind him, like saying, "No, no, no." Like he'd be like, "Come on in," but he's not going to your school. He's going to RBI. So that's how these visits went now with the Division Threes, and then I visited up, yeah, at RPI. Frankie, my best friend that I just met, he went to RPI. We were good teammates. I wasn't going there. I just didn't have that feeling, and I went to Skidmore, and I told him I was going to Skidmore. He's like, you know, he didn't have the greatest of language. I won't say it on your podcast. That's an effing girl school.
Nice. That's funny.
Which it was until like 1972. The thoughts of me going to RPI to code engineer. I love Skidmore. And then now we're going through our basketball life. We went from Mr. DeBacco, Mr. Haber to Coach Martigan. Now another, tough guard, John Petrocci was my college basketball coach. And, we were building, Skidmore was just kind of like varsity for like 10 years, and having men and just started going to school in the 70s. And so we were trying to build it. And, I thought, man, if there were 26 points a game in high school, I'm going to go to D3 and be a dominant.
Absolutely. Yep.
That's not how it goes. There was some difficulty in that.
Yeah, I think that's a challenge, right? When you have your mindset on a particular level. And I think that's a misconception that's still out there today that I'm sure that you run into all the time when you're having conversations with players and parents of players, that I just don't think people have any idea what the level of college basketball looks like. Like how good you have to be to play. I don't care what level of the game, you have to be a really, really, really good player. And I think there's just because everybody sees Division I on TV all the time, and that's what people mostly aspire to because that's what they know. And so then they tend to think, oh, Division II, Division III, JUCO, whatever, that those levels of basketball, I don't think high school players and parents really have a good understanding. A lot of cases, high school coaches, unless they've had a lot of experience with players going to play college basketball, even I think high school coaches sometimes underestimate how good the basketball is at the college level. And so I can completely understand you coming in and being like, hey, I was a guy that, I think of myself as a Division I player. Now I'm going to go to Division III and I'm coming in, I'm going to be the man. And so what was the biggest adjustment? I mean, obviously there's the standard answer of guys are just bigger and faster. Yeah, right. I mean, that's the answer. But beyond that, what do you remember about just, even if you talk about specific guys or just, man, I had to match up against so-and-so and this guy just was kicking my tail or whatever it was.
And that's a great point. Sidney Blair was a 6'3 long guard from Zionsville, Indiana. And I'm a 5'10 guard, and he was long. Tate Rice was a 6'4 wing from Syracuse. These guys are just, I'm 5'10. And at my level, I could dribble post up. I could score the mid range. I wasn't really a 3-point shooter. At that point, I could make them, but it wasn't really my game. And at 5'10", it was hard to score on 6'3", 6'4" guards that were 2-3 years older than you. That's with some adjustment. And then being local, I was 40 minutes from my high school, and everybody was seeing, like, what's wrong with Andre? He's averaging, I look back now and I average by like 6.5. It's not bad.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good.
Yeah, you look back at it now that I've been doing it for a long time, like, geez, that's not bad. But, you have a freshman, I got a freshman that we're really high on. If you told me right now, Mike, that he's going to average 6.5 for us, I'd be like, terrific. Sign me up.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. So, you have heard the standard answer of speed, size, of course, that's all. But it was just I had to change my game. Of I could get to the mid range. I could even post up a little bit because I was kind of crafty down there, and that wasn't happening. And I had to come. And I wasn't consistent enough of a shooter to be as successful as I wanted to be. So that was a process of I got to get better. Hundreds of shots to change my game. And it's a time. If you talk to my college coach, you probably would say he's a little worried about me because I'm not athletic, you know. But we started to it has to go back. Like what you said about I wouldn't change it for the world. We played against it, and you are in the heart of UAA, right? The UAA Division III conference, right there with Case Western, right?
Yep. Yep.
Good. And that's a terrific league, right? And with Rochester, NYU, University of Chicago, we played Williams, Amherst, Bowdoin, Bates, Middlebury. I mean, good teams and beautiful campuses. I wouldn't change it for the world. But it was that, that early going was you really have a look in the mirror of how good am I? Right.
Like, yeah.
I'm at Division III, struggling, and how are we gonna make this? How are we gonna make this career a success?
So, have you used that experience when you're talking to players that you've coached over the years in terms of helping them to adjust to? Hey, everybody who comes and plays college basketball was probably one of the best players on their high school team. They've kind of always been the big fish, and now suddenly you're coming in and you got to compete, and maybe you're not getting the minutes that you think you're going to get. And we know that there's this, obviously today more so than ever, there's this transfer mentality of, hey, things aren't going well early and I'm going to get out, and people at home are telling me I should be playing and I should be this and I should be that, or I should leave. So I'm assuming that your own personal experience, you've been able to utilize that in conversations with players. So maybe just talk a little bit about how you use your own experiences to be able to relay to players, hey, you gotta stick with it.
No, that's a great question. And one thing that I say, if you say back in my day,
right? Yeah, you never want to say that.
No, it's like when I played, their turn their ears off, right? That's not. But the one thing I do say to them is I can look it in the eye and say, I have been in every role, everything that you guys are going through, I have been in every role you have been. I have been the freshman that's just trying to figure out how to get some minutes on the court. I have been that role player where you're, that fringe starter to sixth or seventh man. I have been that guy. I have been the starter that's averaged 13 points, kind of the third or fourth option, and I have been the first option, right? All of that. So when the kid that is the freshman that's the eighth or ninth man, I can say I have been in your shoes. I get it. The kid that's trying to break into the starting lineup, I say, yeah, I remember being in your shoes. I understand that. I can, and I think obviously there are great coaches, great, that never played, didn't play. So I'm not saying anything about that. But I think there is part of being able to look them in the eye and I know exactly. I know when you have to be the guy that's got to get 20 tonight. I know that pressure for us to win. I got to get 20, and I also know that pressure of struggling to get minutes, team winning. That dichotomy of I'm happy we won, but I'm frustrated I didn't play. And how do I put on a positive face to not hurt the team? So I think all of those roles, I can communicate with our guys that I've been there. I do understand it, and I think I can help you through that. I think that's what we can appreciate. I always laugh and tell them what I would do against them if I say if I was 20, this is how the game would go, Jeff. This is right. What I would do to you, and they all like, come on, coach, you're 5'10", and they, I think, they, I think you can relate to that. And, you know, again, if it's every day coming in and you're talking about your glory days, the players will shut down fast.
Yeah, especially the further away you get from those glory days.
Yes.
It's one thing if you're 24 and those are your glory days are like 2 years ago, then it's a little bit easier to sort of back it up. When you're 30 years removed from your glory days, it doesn't pack quite the same punch. Let's put it that way.
I can remember being 24 and being the head coach and, you know, just done with my playing days. I can remember those days. You're like, she's I would play pickup with them every day.
Right, exactly.
Coach is pretty good. Now I find, I find some students maybe right throughout
the game. Yeah, my standard answer whenever somebody comes up and asks me something about, this or that or playing, and I'm always like, that was a long time ago. That's my standard answer.
A long time ago. College in 1994.
No question about that. All right, so thinking back to college, while you're playing, I know you said earlier that you kind of knew from your experience with high school basketball and your high school coach that you knew you wanted to go the coaching route. But at the same time, I could feel your passion for being a player. So while you were playing, were you looking at things also from a coaching perspective, trying to think about, okay, what are we doing and why are we doing it? And what am I learning about coaching? Or at that point, were you still strictly like, hey, I'm a player and I'll shift over to coaching once my playing career is over?
No, and your question literally, brings up another memory. Yeah, I appreciate this walk path down the basketball life because it does. I was coaching. I was too much as a senior. And I was where I was on the court and dictating traffic and saying, you got to go here. And I remember a post-game, Vince Medici, who is a long time, who I actually saw this weekend as well, a long time, my son's godfather. We've been friends since I was 14 years old. And he was a high school, junior college, and Division III college basketball coach. And he came to one of my games as a senior. And again, I was, more focused on making sure the other four guys needed to get them in the right spots than my own game. And we went out to dinner after the game. He's like, hey, man, you got whatever it was, 15 college games left. Will you just play and enjoy them? stop stressing out the coach. And again, I remember, the last guy did it ever. Just stop with all the coaching. You know you're going to get into coaching. You have a good coach. Just play. And it really helped my senior year. It really helped me enjoy it. Because I was done. I was done. My last game was in a tournament against Binghamton. When we got beat, I was done because I was, again, 5'10", not only athletic. I had to take all those shots. I had to do all those extra. I was done jumping rope. I was done shooting all those shots. I was done with the extra work. I just was done to try to, to be as successful as I could college basketball player. I was, March 5th, 1994, when we got beat by Binghamton, I was done. I was ready for the next part.
So that next phase is, What are you thinking at that point? I know you went on and you got a master's in teaching from Union College, but just what was the thought process when you graduate? Were you thinking at that point high school coaching? Were you thinking college coaching? Because I know you got an opportunity to work with the Union College team. So just talk a little bit about where your mind was at.
It was for sure going to be a college coach. There was never a thought of being a high school basketball coach. I can remember 1994, the Final Four was in Charlotte. I remember being in Charlotte, talking to people. I need to get into grad school. I need to find a spot. That's how you thought you did it. And maybe it was more prevalent back in those days. And, who do I get? What grad assistant spot do I get? one of the schools that my grandfather said he's not going there, you know, are probably our biggest rival, Union College, in Phil Stanley. And, you know, I got a grad assistant. I had to get into the grad school because the education program was really good. Then I got the grad assistant lived in Schenectady, and coached with Coach Scanlon, for a couple years. The only time in my life I was an assistant, was my 2 years at Union as a coach.
What do you remember about that piece of it in terms of being an assistant that has helped you as a head coach to maybe understand what your assistants are going through or what their mindset and thought process is as they're working in your program?
Yeah, it was a tough time. The full-time assistant, my second year now, the full-time assistant took a year off, sabbatical. Not really gone much, you would think, at the Division III level. So as a second year grad assistant, I was basically the full-time assistant coach. And the program was sliding. And unfortunately, that was Coach Scanlon's last year as the head coach. He was removed at the end of that year. And I just remember, like, he was such a good, you know, his daughter was Miss New York State basketball, played at Duke. He had another daughter that was played at Tulane. His son is currently a professor at Virginia. I mean, these were high powered. I mean, just a great, great family. And I wanted so bad for him. I wish I could do something. I wish I could have put the sneakers back on. But it was just slipping out of his hands, you know, and there was a little bit of losing touch. And so I guess I saw the part. I appreciate everything he did. I wanted to definitely do whatever I could to help. And I was, you know, teaching during the day. I was in class. I was working. And, geez, I think I slept 5 hours a day to try to do everything, to try to help him. And it was kind of, the program just kind of slipped out of his hands at that point. So I knew, I guess I saw a side of, like, you know, man, you can get fired. Even a guy that's been at the place for 30 years,
right?
You know, can get fired. And I saw that part even at a Division III level, and it made me understand, like, you know, this college coaching isn't all sunshine and rainbows. You know, it isn't all just, you know, everybody puts their hand in the middle and you sing Kumbaya. And it's all, you know, there is a part to it that is a business that you have to win. And then otherwise, you know, somebody else to do it.
That makes complete sense. And I think when you start thinking about sort of the what makes any job, I mean, coaching obviously is something that we all talk about, the other pieces of coaching and how important they are in terms of developing your student athletes and what they do in the classroom, what they do in the community. But I think a lot of times you see that there still has to be winning attached to those things. Obviously, yeah. you want all of them, but when you start talking about the college level, even at the high school level, ultimately, most of the time you end up being judged by wins and losses. Now, you can maybe mitigate that some with some of the other things, but you definitely get to see a side where if you're winning, then everybody talks about how important those other things are. But if you're not winning, then those other things become a little less important when it comes time for your job security, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's very tertiary, fourthary, right? You know, it's,
right.
It is, and that's what I, you know, now being a head coach for 27 years, like, I used to, when I first started coaching, I was what my record was. Right. If you saw me my first year of coaching high school, I took over a program that had 14 straight losing seasons. We were 7-16. If you saw me walking down the street, I looked like a guy that was 7-16. I was depressed. I had bags under my eyes. I wasn't sleeping. You know, and that's when everybody looked at me. Forget about, like, you know, your playing career, you know, 1,000 points here. That like, I was 7-16 in my first year as head coach. Now, you know, you can you have more of life and you can understand and put it in better perspective. That doesn't mean that you don't, you know, winning isn't still super important, but I that is a tough part of it. And I would say this, Mike, like we all don't get to ride out on our white horse at the end of our career, you know, and like, it doesn't always work like that. And you see a lot of stories of, you know, coaches at the end of their career and not leaving how they would like, you know, that we all don't get the Mike Krzyzewski story, you know, where 75, you know, everywhere he goes, it's Coach K, you know, some people don't get that. And you know, in that part of it is, it's difficult. You have to win. And bigger bells used to say, every 10 years, you got to go, you should probably get a chain.
You're right.
You know, because after 10 years, your jokes aren't funny anymore. People aren't as excited to see you. You know, it's like, you know, sometimes you need to freshen them up. And so, you know, all of that, all of those things go into coaching. And as you guys know, it's hard to win one game. Jeez, hard. A lot went into that game. And then you see coaches about 30, 35. But tomorrow, you know, I know this will air after. But tomorrow, one of my players' father is the assistant coach for his father. So tomorrow, I get to see the great Coach Pop.
Oh, that's awesome.
Can't wait. I mean, look at that guy. 73. I mean, what? I can't wait. I'm not sure I'll sleep tonight. You know, I'm thinking about going to, you know, I'm going to be nervous just to shake the man's hand tomorrow at practice.
Coach Pop might not be sleeping. His team, it may be a rough year for Pop and the Spurs.
I think they know that.
I think
they're okay with that. I thought, and I talked to Matt Nielsen, he's my player's father, but, you talk a lot of hoops, and the fact that, you know, just, you know, going off topic, or the fact that Greg Popovich, who some will say is the great, you know, greatest basketball coach that's ever lived, the fact that he knowingly is going to coach a team that's probably going to, that wants to win 20 games.
Right, right? Exactly.
They don't want to win 35. They don't. They want to win 20, and the fact that he said, I heard him say, he wants to find winning in losing to set up these young guys to have a long career in the NBA. Imagine having that type of persona that you could be the great Greg Popovich. And, you know, again, I talked to Matt about the early practices that, you know, my college team might be older than his pro team. You know? And he's like, Andre, the energy in the gym is going to be crazy. So I can't wait to see it. That's 73-year-old Coach Greg Popovich. To be able to do that, to know that he's probably going to go 24 and 58 this year. It's amazing.
It really is. When you think about what he's done, what he's accomplished in his career, and how good winning feels, and having been to that mountaintop 5 different times with the Spurs,
yes.
And then now you're looking at it where you go into a season not hoping, hey, we can compete, not hoping that we can win a title, but instead understanding that it's about development and being able to, I don't know that any coach is ever going to be okay with losing, but understanding the fact that I have to be able to handle those emotions. I have to be able to look past the result on the scoreboard and see if I can't figure out another way to measure how I'm impacting the players that are on his team. And yeah, I think for somebody to do that at this point in his career and do it knowingly, it's not like he's going in
yes.
where you got two guys. Yeah, yes. Like two guys get hurt and all of a sudden you're down at the bottom. This is something that they're going into the season, as you said, knowingly, and they don't want to win games. I mean,
hopefully.
Correct. Right. Yeah. Correct. That would be a very weird and strange, I think it would be very odd as a coach to sort of go into that with the idea that there's this bigger picture. And obviously in college and high school, that's just not it's not something that would ever happen. But in the pros, it would just be interesting to pick his brain or to just talk to other coaches who have been in that situation. You think about like Brett Brown with the Process Sixers. And what's that like where your franchise is actively trying not to win? Obviously not the players on the floor, not the coaching staff,
right,
but you're almost, if when you're doing all these things to work hard to try to win games and you're basically counteracting what everybody in the building wants to happen, except for maybe the 12 or 15 guys that are on the practice floor every day. It's crazy.
It really is. Like, you know, I'll get to see Brett Brown there tomorrow as well. He's back on Pop's staff. So, he just got back to the States. And, so it really is. I mean, when you think about the great coaches that we've, you know, watched and, I mean, do you think Phil Jackson can do that? I'm not saying I don't know these guys, but could Phil Jackson do what Greg Popovich is doing? Pat Riley knowingly do that? I just don't think so.
No, I don't think so. I think Pop is one of those things where he has such, and obviously it's been talked about before, but he has this persona of, you know, being that gruff and his sideline interviews and all those kinds of things. But then when you read the more in-depth stories or you hear people talk about him and what he's like and the team dinners and you think about how he rallied the team after they lose to LeBron and the Ray Allen shot and then they come back the next year and beat Miami. Like, there's no way as a coach to be able to do that, to be able to have the strength of character and just to be able to rebound and come back from something like that with the same group of guys. To me, that ability, that resilience is just incredible. Again, there's a reason why the guys are the greatest. There's a reason why great coaches are great coaches. And there's a reason why great players are great players. There's just things that they have that just ordinary mortals just don't have the same capability. And so I think it's a testimony to him that he's willing to step in there and do that. It really is incredible.
At 73.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
He could do why just very easily tomorrow say, I don't want to do it.
Yeah, right, for sure.
People would say, I get it. But
he could just get his courtside seat and sit across the way and watch, right?
Yes.
Be a lot less stressful.
And anyway, so tomorrow we're talking about great coaches, and tomorrow I get an opportunity. Well, now whether I get to meet him or not, you know, maybe depends on how practice is going or his mood. But I will be courtside for the Spurs practice tomorrow.
That's awesome. That's going to be a lot of fun. Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more. When you think about learning, right, that's one of the things that as a coach throughout your career, you're always trying to listen and learn and figure things out. So when you were a young coach, where'd you go to learn? Who did you go to? Did you have mentors? Were you reading, watching film, all of the above? Just what do you remember about trying to improve your craft as a young coach when you were coaching a high school team?
Wow. Yeah, it was, I look back to coaching in 1996. And again, so if you talk about like, you know, what was my thought process? Like, I'm going to go to college, right? And, you know, I had some opportunities, you know, those 15,000 live on campus meal plan type of assistants, right? Jobs.
Right.
And again, I go back to my grandfather. He's like, hey. He didn't say it so nicely. He's like, you got these degrees. Why don't you apply for a teaching job? you know, I'm like, so yeah, just a plot, yeah. So there was a couple of spots that Hudson Falls High School and Amsterdam High School, you know, again, out near the Albany area, that I got a social studies job, and Hudson Falls had the varsity job open, and Amsterdam was going to be assistant for 1 year and then take over the program. I don't know why I had this kind of confidence or arrogance of coaching. I didn't do anything, but I'm like, I'm going to go take the head job.
Of course, why not? Yeah, absolutely.
And I'm going to do this for 4 years, and I'm going to get out of here. Right. That was the thing. So, and, oh, you know, the players and these kids were wonderful. And I obviously don't mean to disparage those kids at all that are no longer kids now. They're, you know, 30, you know, 40 some years old, right?
right.
You know, they, these were good. It wasn't a basketball place. It was a football school. And no one talked about basketball. It was an afterthought. And then here comes a principal named Mark Duty that was a former basketball coach. And that's him coaching ESM, knowing my high school coach, Coach Martin, is what got me the job, got me the door, and got me the head job at 24. Teach full-time world history, you know, and oh my god, I knew American history. I got to know now, learn about Asia and, you know, the Middle East while I'm trying to figure out how to coach basketball. And, probably early on, it probably was just Coach Martin, Coach Petrucci, like, we're bad and we're trying to turn this thing around, and how are we going to do that? And all she knew was, I'm just going to work harder, watch more film, get in the gym more. That's all we know if my offense worked. I didn't know how to really teach defense, you know, but I knew we were just going to work and get the skill better. We had to get the skill better. We just spent time with, in particular, the younger kids getting better, getting love basketball. They follow me around this little community like the Pied Piper. Here's this 24-year-old, and they were like, let's go, coach, let's go to the open gym. And it was fun, and we got better. And we went from, you only played 20 games in all. We went from 7 wins to 10 wins to 17 wins to 20 wins in 4 years. It was like, okay, I get out now. I turned around, we won a championship, we took our team to the Glens Falls Civic Center, all of those first days in history. It was great. We had some college, we developed some kids that from that 8th grade, 9th grade class when I first got there were college players. You're starting to figure out, like, I can't be George Martin, like, that's not who I am. And you're really starting to develop, like, what works for you.
Right.
And I was doing it as a head coach. You know what I mean? Like, not as an assistant and how would I do this? I was thrown right into the fire, 24 years old, had assistant coaches in the 40s, my JV coach, my assistant coach, all had families. And who's this young punk? What do you think he knows? And it was trying to figure it all out, and I'm sure I made a lot of mistakes back then. But you figure out who you want to be, how you want to coach, what your thoughts are on offense, what your thoughts are on defense, and you're just kind of formulating that throughout the years. And then as your podcast and others, now I can hear how other people are doing it. Now it's watching a lot of film.
Right.
I'm in a constant state of listening to other coaches and their podcasts and jotting things down and saying, that's great. But back then, it was more talking to the local college coaches and other high school coaches, just trying to get it all figured out. And doing it as a head coach. Again, tons of mistakes. But again, I wouldn't change my circuitous route in coaching. I wouldn't change it.
Well, it's also something to be said for when you're learning on the job and you got to figure things out, that experience. Now, maybe for those kids that played for you in those early years, they might be like, oh, coach, man, I remember when you did this or that, right?
Yeah.
But, But the reality is that probably over the course of time, that ability to experiment and try and fail and do this and try that probably led you to a place where it made you a better coach in the long run for having gone through that experience and being able to do and be a head coach at such an early age gave you a leg up as you move forward, because you just had so many more games of coaching and being able to run your own program. And obviously you eventually left the high school level and move on to the college level, which we can talk about here in a second. But
yeah,
I think just gaining that experience was a huge piece of it. By the end of that high school experience, did you feel like you had kind of got a hold of how you wanted to coach, where you were no longer just kind of mimicking what you had seen from your high school and college coach? When did you feel like you kind of came into your own? Was that while you were still coaching in high school, or did that not happen until you got to college?
I don't think it happened until I got to college of who I really, in junior college started to develop, like, who I wanted to be as a coach, how I can envision how offense should be played, and how to articulate that. You know, I had thoughts, and all right, as a 5'10 guard that had it, that wasn't overly athletic, that had to have a plan to be able to be successful. That's how I see the game, right? Like, that's how my mindset has always been. How can I, that's kind of how my coaching is developed. The 5'10 guard that, you know, is trying to figure out how to come off stagger screens and block the action and how to keep your feet right and all, you know. So how do you develop that offense, and how do you, where does that come from? And I probably got to me to get to college to be able to even articulate who I am, what I envision, and these are my thoughts. And but that's still I'm going to a wedding Saturday with my former players, and I'm going to see probably 15 of them there, all of that probably 7 to 10 years ago. And even they would say, the offense has changed since they played. And they probably would say, as a lot of the older players, like, geez, coach, you guys saw. And that's probably true, too. It's probably all true.
Different era, right? I mean, it's a different era.
At the end of my tenure in Hudson Falls, I was an assistant principal, and they made me an interim principal because our principal became a superintendent, and they offered me the principal's job and said, but you can't coach anymore. And I was like, whoa, how did this happen so fast, Mike? I was 30 years old, and now I'm going to be a principal of a high school. I was going to be a college coach. Wait a minute. How did this happen? And, I kind of had to get back on track and realize, like, all right, if there's an opportunity to get in college, I'm going to seize that. And that happened at Hudson Valley.
How does that opportunity come across your desk?
Crazy. Drew Maritello, who's the athletic director currently at Boston University, was an assistant football coach when I was a grad assistant at Union College. We're both at Union. And, even the current AD at Union College, Jimmy McLaughlin, he was an assistant football coach. And we all sat in the back offices. We're all in our 20s. We're all trying to figure it out. We all had dreams and visions of how life was going to go. And Drew was, I was probably, 23, 24. Drew was probably 26, 27. Drew became the athletic director at Hudson Valley Community College. And at the time, Drew and I have been friends for, 20, how many years is that now? 25, 27 years. And Drew, the job at Hudson Valley was part-time. And so while Drew was interviewing the candidates, he was calling me on every candidate. Andre, what are you? He's a football guy. Andre, this guy, I'm interviewing this guy. What do you think? Andre, I'm bringing in this guy on Wednesday. What do you think? And so every candidate come in, like Drew and I would have, I knew it all, right, from being in the area my whole life. So he called me up, and I'm like, and the candidates are also calling me. And so he says, I go, it sounds like I know you've been busy. How's it going? He goes, I want to interview one more candidate. And I said, who's that? He's like, you. I go, true. I got an assistant principal. I'm making good money. My daughter was just born. My wife, Stacy, she will kill me. I can't do that part time. What if I said I can make it full time? I said, oh, okay. That's interesting. Okay. He's like, let's talk on Monday. You know, come talk to your wife. He asked me what I made at the time. He's like, I can't get you for that number, but talk to your wife about what is a doable salary. What can you do? Talked to my wife. I said, we talked about this number. I gave it to Drew, and it was probably a $30,000 to $35,000 pay cut. And, and I gave my wife a lot of, I talked to Drew. Drew's like, I think I can make that happen. That number. He did some work. Just, I got you that number. I can give you that number. So, talked to my wife, and here we go. We took the pay cut. We got a little baby girl. We moved back down. Hudson Valley Community College is literally 2 minutes from Waterloo High School, and got the job. And like I said, life has changed, baby girl. We moved back, basically back home, and we took the job at Hudson Valley.
What do you remember about walking in that first day and thinking about what you needed to do? How familiar were you with the JUCO level of basketball that you were now going to be coaching? Just where was the state of the program? And then how prepared do you feel like you were to be able to do the things that needed to be done in order to get it where you wanted it to go?
It was probably, well, I just mentioned Vince Medici, right? My longtime friend, my son's, yes. my son's godfather. He got the job. All this opened up, all these connections and how these things all work out. Vince was the head coach at Hudson Valley, and Vince got the job at SUNY Oleanza. And I would say, Vince was part time, so Vince was teaching. He was driving in the Hudson Valley. I think he just got worn out after doing that for 9 years. But he had enough success where it allowed him to get another job. I just think the job at that, if you're ever at Hudson Valley Community College, that 5,000 seat arena, that football stadium, it's got, at the time, it had a hockey team. The Astros Class A baseball team plays on campus. It had all of these amenities. I just think it needed some juice back into the game. And I was hoping to be able to do that. And I also wanted to do it with local players. There was no housing at the time, or limited housing. I wanted Hudson Valley and Albany to be destination sounds kind of weird, but I wanted to be everybody be okay with, whatever the stigma is with community college or junior college, whatever anybody thought of that, let's make this where we want to go there. If you want to go to be a scholarship player, let's start here first. And if you want to go to Division III with high money academic, let's cut that in half. And we had all this slit streak. And I think we got it to where, and it was an exciting career. We got it to, we're number one in the country with all Albany kids. So we were getting great crowds, great energy. Albany's a basketball area. I felt I could do that. And then when I got the job in August, and I said, we may not be very good this first year. But, it was, again, just a great move for me. I would probably have been fine with staying there forever. It was a great spot. I was back home. People were happy to, people were happy to see me back and come to the games. And not that Huffington Falls was far, but I literally was living in my hometown.
What do you think was the key to your success there at Hudson Valley? And then how did that lead you to the opportunity that you currently have at St. Edward?
Yeah, I really just think it was, we got the bet. We just had open people's eyes that look at this place. For basketball, it was okay. And we have a local guy that has local college degrees with Skidmore and Union coaching at, year full time in junior college, or I can walk into the gym. And I'm not trying to say I was anything special, but people knew what about us. So those kids I went to a gym in Lansingburg or Mechanical or Saratoga or Albany, Schenectady, were like, that's not some Valley folks. We can talk to that man. He's looking at, we want our kids to go there, and he's got a vision and a thought process, and then it became okay for some bounce backs. He had a Tiki Maven. Tiki Maven as a freshman was the number one player in the country. As a freshman in high school, number one point guard in the country. He got impact, 6'5" point guard. Daquan Hemingway, Justin Gallo, who just got into the Hall of Fame. These are truly terrific players. And we were playing D3 JUCO, and I think the last 2 years there we were 62-5.
And so from there, you've been in the New York area your entire life. Now you're in Austin, Texas. Life. So that is quite a trip cross country. And obviously it's not just you at that point. You have a family and you have other people that you have to factor into that decision. So what are those conversations like when the opportunity at St. Edward's comes up? What do you remember about talking through the whole opportunity with your wife?
Well, your basketball life, another seminal moment. Ryan Marks, I know Ryan Marks since the 90s. He was a coach at Southern Vermont. And he came to my high school gym. And Ryan is eclectic, different. You'd see Ryan and you wouldn't think basketball coach. But he's a terrific, smart guy. And he had great success. And he got Southern Vermont. He comes to my gym. Again, Ryan. Got shorts on, sandals. It's 12 degrees outside, and he comes to my gym and he's a pretty nice one. So that started a relationship probably about 1998. Ryan went to Southern Vermont, and three of my guys in Southern Vermont. He goes to St. Edward's in Austin, and I go to Hudson Valley. Guess what? I'm still recruiting my guys. One of my guys, Justin Gallo, he recruits, and I'm like, hey, Ryan, I'm going to come to Austin and with Justin, and I don't do every recruiting trip. Come to Austin, I'm like, wow, this is great. Oh, jeez. Love the place, love the people. Was at the games. I went to a couple games. See Ryan, staying with him. We saw Austin. Like, wow, we got a good spot, man. It's a good game. So that was it. Justin didn't go there. I don't know. He had Division I dreams as well. We go about our business. The next year, we go 32-4. We get to the national semifinal. Ryan Marks gets the kind of the UTPA job, and which is now UTRGV. And I was literally sitting in my office. Hey, Rob, congratulations, man. I'm very happy for you. You think I had any chance at your job? If he said no, I wouldn't have got the resume. And he said, you do. It's about the right fit here. I see it. So they phone interview for 14 to find the campus. And at that time, now we have, make another move, Colin was a baby. I have a 6-year-old and a 6-month-old, soon to be 6-year-old and a 6-month-old. And my wife and I, our whole lives have been within, 60 miles of Albany.
Right.
And now, her parents, my grandparents, none of them were alive, right? So we just said, if we're going to make a move, even though we have family back there in Albany, we're going to make a move. There's nothing really holding us. And, I love her. She's like, had faith in me. And she's like, all right, let's do it. And I went a couple months before her. She packed up the whole house. She packed up the kids. She did all of it while I was trying to figure out, which way is Dallas, which way is San Antonio, which way is Houston, and trying to get a little bit of a plan. I remember them coming down the escalator, like, you lived in a 900 square foot apartment for the first 9 months. We had a pretty good life in Albany, and believe me, Mike, there were many nights in those first couple of years when I'm like, I screwed this whole thing up. What a bad decision.
What were the things that when you went through the interview process that you felt like were in place that made you feel like you could have success? Maybe not immediate success in your first year, but that long term, you felt like it was a place that you could win. And then to go along with that, what were the things that you thought needed to be upgraded, improved, things that you thought you could bring to the table that could allow the program to get where you wanted to go?
I think, first of all, the 10 full scholarship, right? It's, you know, and for a school that is, and this is not just me saying it, it's U.S. News and World Report, it's the best academic school in the league, right? And now the price tag is about $65,000, $66,000. So it could be hard to get, like, half scholarship guys, because they're still going to have to pay $30,000, you know? So
right,
the
right,
fact that
right.
we had, you know, we still have, we had 10 full scholarships, our location, you know, many publications would say Austin is the best city that this country has, right? There would be many where it's number one, best place to live, Austin, best. Some publications would say that. But I thought, you know, that's a great thing. What a great, you know, what is it? You can build a niche. We're not the University of Texas. Yes, it's right down the road, obviously. But we could build our niche. I thought we could do that. Now, the things that were like, you know, that time the president wasn't really a sports guy. He didn't really see, like, how he understood that we needed sports and athletics, that it could bring campus vibrancy. But it was kind of like we were off on our own island, in a sense. So that was, you know, that was always a little disconcerting. I thought, you know, but the full scholarship, the city, It fit my personal academic profile, that I thought, you know, being spending time at private liberal arts schools, like, I thought I could, I just didn't know Texas. I drove all over, the state, met people, flew, but I didn't make any real connections. And that's probably where I made some mistakes early. Shook a lot of hands, but no real relationships.
Yeah, that's really important, obviously, when you get in and you start talking about coming in from an outside area where you had already built up all your contacts, relationships with high school coaches, and just from growing up there, you had people that you've known forever, and then you go to a completely new area, and all of a sudden you're like, okay, if I'm going to recruit, I got to start building those relationships with high school coaches. I got to start building relationships with AAU coaches, and you're basically starting completely from scratch. How did you approach that from a staff standpoint?
If I had to do it over again, I mean, you know, it, now that I've been in Texas now, entering my 14th year, you know, now Austin is very different. But when you go throughout Texas, Texas is, you know, and everywhere you go, you'll see a Texas flag. This state has a ton of pride, and they don't want a Yankee coming in here and winning. You know, they don't want some New Yorker coming down to their state and winning. So it wasn't like they were like, yeah, let's help you and beat other Texans. That was not their mantra. It was they were very pleasant and nice, and they shook hands and said, yeah, no, we'll think about it, and I would lose out. So that took time building up their trust in me figuring out, you know, what life in Texas, what works at St. Ed's, what works in Austin. You know, a kid that grew up in Lubbock may not necessarily think Austin is a spot for them. So I had to figure some of that out, right? Like, okay, you know, probably got to stay in the major cities, the Dallas's, the Houston, the San Antonio. We got to figure out what our niche is, get some Northeast kids. But I just knew New York, so we had a lot of New York guys, had a New York assistant. If I could have did it all over, and I don't want any disrespect to my first assistant, David Martin, I love him, he's right from here at the ball, I would have just probably just said, let me just take this first year, because again, I didn't get the job till late. Let me just take this first year and assess everything. You know, let me just sit, assess, coach the guys I have, don't make any moves, don't sign any long-term contracts, don't get any of this, let me just assess. And, you know, I think I got into some long-term contracts, you know, with scholarships. We were trying to get some New York guys, you know, we were figuring out Texas. And, you know, first year was hard. I mean, I think, you know, I just finished Coach K book. No way am I myself to him for the first 3 years. We were under 500, you know, and it was, man, oh man, I might have screwed this up. I left happy, and I got, a baby of two kids under, seven, and it was hard.
Once you get in there and you start to see all those things and you start to build those relationships, was there a moment where you felt like, okay, we've kind of arrived? Was there one singular moment, maybe a game, maybe just a recruit that you finally were able to get? Or was it more just a gradual build where it came, you're like, okay, now we're here? Was it one moment or was it gradual?
I think it could be both, but I'm going to talk about one moment that really I like. And again, ironically, I'm going to his wedding on Saturday. His name is John Graham. He was an attorney at SMU Law School. I said to him, we were getting some JUCO guys and some New York guys. Great kids, of course. We were winning. I was trying to fit a square peg into a round hole. It just wasn't working. And I said to Debbie Taylor, who's still our athletic director, I said, you probably don't, I can understand why you don't think that I'm the guy, right? And this happened like year three. I can understand why if you wanted to go a different direction. I would. We're 35 and 47 or whatever. It's whatever the numbers were at the time. I said, but I think now that I've been here, I think I have an idea, a plan of how I want to do this. We got to go back. We got to get some high school kids. So I had a kid out of Tucson, Arizona, named Frankie Lee. A great kid out of St. Frank's in Tucson. But getting some validity in Brandon Rosenthal, who you and I both know, was the reason why I got Frankie Lee. That was you for Brandon being a Tucson kid. So he was the guy there. John Bramlett out of Anderson High School here in Austin. John was, a great player on his Anderson team, local. And I watched John so many times. Rice was recruiting him, at home visits, and he was on the Rice board, just like when we started this conversation, like I was on the Holy Cross and Holy Board. I thought, man, Rice was seriously recruiting him. But he Rice got somebody else who's off the board, and we got John Graham. I can remember right where I was in my neighborhood walking through John's and he's going to come. And that was like, yes, that guy in this city is going to give us credibility. People wanted John. I remember watching him in the regional semifinals with Division I coaches left and right. And John making the big shots, and everyone's like, man, you got a good one. All the Texas schools, the Sam Houston States, all the Southland schools, all those coaches, like, man, St. Ed's has got a good one right there. And I'm like, yeah, we did. Yeah, we did. And that's going to start us. And you had Amir Burton from New York, Ethan Gilbert, another Austin kid. And then we start piecing in some transfers. Trey Lindsey, who's my longtime assistant, is coaching high school. We start pacing it, and now we're 18 wins, 22 wins, and now we're on our way.
What do you think has been the key to your sustained success? So once you get the program to the point where you're winning, now I think probably the hardest thing is to be able to maintain and keep that edge. So over the course of your 10 years there, what has been the key to your continued success?
I think like it's having the confidence of going, we've got a product to sell. Like, this isn't, we're a beautiful campus on the hill in Austin, Texas. It's got the best look of the city, of downtown Austin. It's a terrific academic school. We're a sister school, Catholic Holy Cross. We're a sister school of Notre Dame. We've got a product to sell, and it's not it's not just something we're going to give away. And we have to have a cachet about us of like, and I think we, and the winning now has helped. Now it's okay. There's this New York guy. It's like, oh man, they were 34. They won the Sweet 16 in the NCAA tournament. They didn't get the World Star Championship 3 years in a row. Now there's a little bit of swagger's on. You know what I'm saying? Like,
no, I know. Got, yep.
It, you know, that's a great school. I'd love to go to St. Ed's, and we come to people in Texas know us. They know we have. You know, you talked about earlier about understanding your vision of how to coach. I think we have a pretty defined one now that people say they play with an organization. They run good offense. They don't turn the basketball over. They want to shoot the three. They play man-to-man. I think people now can know who we are and know what we're about and know the academic piece. So I think that is, we have this confidence now of, hey, over the last 10 years, we've got a pretty good thing here in South Austin and knowing where we stand. And it's, we can get those transfers, piece them into what we do. I think I have a vision of how I see the game played, and that helps you in your recruiting. You still got to recruit the high school kids because they're the long-term foundational piece, but getting transferred, not just getting transferred to say we got Division I transfers, but saying, hey, we want certain guys, and you're going to love it here. So you see the high school kids, combination of the D1 transfers, and I think we carved out our niche. And, you know, and now you look back, you know, I built hard times early, have led us to, I just really enjoy it. You know, I got a daughter who's a sophomore in college. You know, she goes to Southwestern D3 school, about 40 minutes north of us. My son is an eighth grader. And you just think about those early times, my wife and I have that 900 square foot apartment when I was getting my butt kicked in. Like, you know, and you can look back, she's got a great job now. She's doing great. Everyone's happy in the house. And we took a shot. It wasn't great, but, you know, hung in there. We had some stick-to-itiveness. And I love it. I love seeing our alum. We built up a nice base. And I just feel good about who we are, what we know. Does that mean we don't, as you know, being a new life in basketball, we can't just sit back in our recliner and rest on our laurels. We got to keep figuring this thing out. And my current team will tell you right now that I'm not overly thrilled with them. We've had some bad workouts, you know.
Spoken like a true coach, right there.
They know. I'm gonna tomorrow morning. I'm gonna see them on the track in about 8 hours. They know that I'm not thrilled with them right now. But that's what that you know. Again, we went back to 4 years ago, Mike, and I've enjoyed this conversation with you so much. It's been just to I appreciate you allowing me to talk about my journey in basketball. And you just think about like where it's gone over the 4 years. And the one thing I will still say is like, I can't wait to, I don't mean this to sound cliche. I still love it. I can't wait to get there tomorrow. I really can't, you know, and we got things to figure out with this 22-23 team. And, but I still love it. And that's part of the reason probably why life has gone by so fast is that every day has been, I'm not going to give it away.
That's what it's all about. I think when you start talking about being able to get up and be excited about what you do every single day, there's nothing better. Not a lot of people, unfortunately, get to experience that. You know, there's a lot of people that their work is drudgery, and they get
it's
up
work.
And they're like, their outlook is not the one that you just described. So the fact that you have that opportunity to be able to go and do something that you love and do it at a place that you love, there's nothing better than that. I want to wrap up with a two-part question, Andre. So first part is, when you look ahead over the next year or two, what do you see as being your biggest challenge? And then second part, when you think about what you get to do every single day, what brings you the most joy about being the head coach at St. Edward's?
I appreciate those questions. Challenges over the next year or two is, we are, again, that $65,000 a year school that is coming out of COVID challenge, right? That is trying to bounce back from being in a very liberal city that took COVID very conservatively. And that's hurt us with our total numbers of students. We have a new president that's trying to figure out, other revenues of cash, where to get that, trying to build those students back up, because we had, a year of no actual in face-to-face learning. That hurt. Kids couldn't, only put one in a room. All right, so coming out of that in a small private liberal arts college to get, where our scholarship situation is, where our budgets are, all those are taking a hit, and we're trying to bounce back from that. And we have a new president, Dr. Fuentes, is got a lot of juice. I've had more meetings with her. She's been in front of athletics more times in her short tenure than our previous president has, because she has a passion for sports. So that is my challenge. That's my concern of us bouncing back as a university, and we're working at it. So there is light at the end of the tunnel. What I love every day and bringing great joy is, like, you mentioned you have a daughter that's college age, right? She's a freshman in college. That's what we're coaching now. I have a daughter that's a sophomore in college. So now, back when I was 24, I didn't quite see it like that. So now when these guys come to my office, that's my son. He's 18, 19, and he's got his future. And I have a different view of how I go coaching. I go about it with a different lens. I enjoy my time with them. I like to laugh with them. And I just, that 18 to 22 is such a transformative age and time of these young men. And I just, the fact that I get to be a part of it, again, and that's not cliche. Like, the wins are great. I want to win. I want to win championships. I still have goals and dreams and visions, even at 50 years old. But what I do love is having, we're going to work for 2 hours, and I'm not always going to say nice things to you. I'm not always going to tell you you're wonderful, but it's never personal. You come to my office, we're going to talk about a myriad of things, and I enjoy that relationship. I enjoy the laugh with them. And then I get to see him on the other end. Again, a subject, going to a wedding on Saturday. Guys got an hour, 27, 28, 29, 30, and they're starting their careers, their family. I love it. It's a great job, and it's just a joy.
That's what it's all about, and being able to have that impact, and then not only seeing that impact in the moment, but getting a chance to go to a guy's wedding. I think most coaches would tell you there's nothing better than that. Before we get out, I want to give you a chance to share how people can find out more about you, find out more about your program, connect with you. So whether you want to share email, website, social media, whatever you feel comfortable with, and then I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Awesome. At Coach Andre Cook on Twitter. My email is andrec@stedwards.edu. I'd love to hear from you.
Andre, cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule to jump on with us tonight. It's been fun getting to know a little bit more about you, getting to know your program, and really appreciate your time. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
3R Basketball, powered by Under Armour, is coming to Cleveland this fall. Get your 3-on-3 team together and register at ua3rbasketball.com.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.